I'd like to welcome you, O future teachers of mindfulness meditation. I'm Tara Brock.
And I'm Jack Kornfield. Warm greetings to you. To support you in your training, we've created a special podcast series of the best wisdom teachings from previous years of our teacher training.
Now, we know that sometimes simply listening and not having to watch a screen is a really good way to open, receive, and learn. The wisdom you'll hear is timeless, so while you may hear references to time, you'll easily connect with the truths that are being shared.
May this rich selection of some of our favorite training sessions deepen your understanding of mindfulness and compassion and bring a new dimension to your teaching. We hope you enjoy these special recordings.
Many blessings.
So again, my name is Xiao Jing, and I'm the Program and Finance Director and Jack of All Trades at the East Bay Meditation Center. I go by the pronouns she, her, and they. And you know, we're so excited to be here today with Christine and I to share with you some of our lessons that we've learned in the first 10 years of our meditation center having a space. And just to give you a little bit of background, which some of which you might know since Larry and Conda were both here and they're our beloved teachers. This is our 10th year. We're celebrating our 10-year anniversary, and we're quite proud of that. And we're a meditation center in downtown Oakland. We have a space that holds about 150 to 200 people, and it's just bustling at the seams. We have 7 weekly practice groups. We have about 80 classes and retreats a year. And we're run on an all-Donna generosity model, so we charge no fees for our classes. And you know, each year, I think by our calculations, we have 17,000 individual visits to our center. And we are just constantly growing and learning and want to share some of that with you all today.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Xiao Jing. Hi, everyone. My name is Christine, again, and I go by she, her, hers, or Pocket Diva is my alter ego. Feel free to use that. Anything said with love and affection, I appreciate. So wanted to start, you know, we named this Transforming Our Values into Reality, and wanted to start with telling you a story of how we tried to do this in one way. Is that okay if I start with that? Okay. So several years ago at EBMC, East Bay Meditation Center, we'll constantly be saying EBMC, we were kind of a developing center, and the place wasn't quite busting at the seams yet. And we had some very like stalwart Sangha members, and we were like, oh, we wanted to say yes to everything that they wanted to do because we were like, we need to fill the center. We want more people to get in here. And so EBMC was just kind of saying yes to everything that everybody, a Sangha member wanted to do. And there was one day that one of the most vibrant, committed, energetic members that came through there, had gone through teacher training, was a native Spanish speaker and from a family of immigrants who said, you know, I really, really want to start a Spanish language sangha. And I want to teach some retreats and really service the community. And if anybody has been to Oakland, you know, especially in East Oakland, there's a very, very vibrant Spanish speaking community. And so EBMC was like, yeah, let's do that. And everybody was really excited. And she started teaching a regular sangha. And, you know, we kind of winged it. Everybody was kind of winging it in those years. And she held the group regularly. It met twice monthly. And about a dozen people would show up on a regular basis. And we were like, yes, tried and true dozen are coming through, right? And so we were like, okay, I think we're ready. They want some half day and day long retreats. And that's when we started to run into a couple of things that started to happen. So there was a little bit of tension that started coming up with the teacher because she was like, hey, I could really use some volunteers who could do greeting with folks there. And they should be fully Spanish bilingual. And we were like, oh, let us try to find some of those volunteers. Or I'm going to need all the signs to be up and they should be in English and Spanish. I actually need some help doing some outreach to the Spanish language community here in Oakland. And we couldn't meet those needs. And, you know, it was rough because we had all this great intention. We wanted to build this beautiful, we had these plans, you know, we were like, yeah, let's do this. And really things started to filter out. And she was pretty disappointed that we couldn't meet those needs. And what we realized is that you cannot build a house on unstable foundation. And we were trying to build something that we thought was modest, but we didn't, we weren't quite there. We didn't do enough scoping. It looked really good on paper, but we didn't actually have, didn't have all the supplies. We definitely didn't have all the hands on deck that we needed to build the thing. And so she took the group to somewhere else. And, you know, it was fair and it was right. And we see it as a point of learning. And so now what we're doing at the center is we're really trying to take those lessons. One of the things we talked about is like, you can't build a whole house on one person. It's not enough to have a champion, no matter how great their commitment and their intention is, it's not going to be enough to hold up the house. And so, you know, we really think about what does it mean to form beloved community? And this is one of my favorite quotes from Bell Hooks. Beloved community is formed not by the eradication of difference, but by its affirmation, by each of us claiming all of the identities and cultural legacies that shape who we are and how we live in this world. So what we wanted to share today is really about not just diversity and inclusion, but what does it look like to affirm with positive joy all of who we are? What does it mean to try to build a beloved community that in its structure, in its foundation, is a welcoming house to everybody? And that's kind of what we want to talk about and share with you all. So we wanted to imagine, I wanted to, if you all are interested in this, if you feel comfortable and you think you won't fall asleep, I want to invite you into an imagining exercise. So if you feel comfortable, I invite you to close your eyes. And I want you to imagine a center or group. Imagine you're walking down a street. It could be a city center or a town. And you hear cars around and people talking and laughing. Maybe there's some dogs. And you walk up and you're about to enter a center or a group. Maybe it's yours. Maybe it's a colleague of yours, one you've been wanting to enter. And the first thing you see as you enter the door is you see these posters that have a beautiful diversity of faces of teachers who teach there. There are classes that are offered at all times and weekends. And you're like, wow, there's a lot going on at the center. So you open the door and you step in. And the first thing you see is a smiling face and they say, welcome. Welcome to the center. And you see that there's a lot of spaciousness and you actually see somebody who's who's differently abled in a wheelchair coming across the room. You also see as you turn, you're like, oh, I kind of need to use the bathroom. And the bathrooms have gender neutral signage. You're like, which one do I enter? And you're like, I can enter any. You walk in, you continue to walk in, and you see an altar that has different statues, different people's pictures of family. And you hear laughter, you hear welcome. Maybe you smell food from a potluck that comes along with the event that you're there with. There's spices you can identify and some that you can't. Maybe you smell wafting tea. And you notice that in the kitchen that everything is kind of at waist level, very easy to reach, and you can grab a warm cup of tea and hold it in your hands. You can taste clean air. You notice that there's air filtration there. And maybe you're sensitive, maybe you have asthma, maybe you can't do fragrances, and you feel like the air is clean and you can breathe fully. Maybe you feel and look around and you can sit in a chair, there's cushions, you can stand, there's even a compassion room where the light is low if you're not feeling like you want to be around a lot of people and oversensitized. Notice how you feel. What's happening in your body? What's happening in your heart? You open your eyes and somebody says, welcome to the Sangha. Welcome home. I invite you to open your eyes when you feel ready. we talk a lot in the practice about, in story practice, actually, we talk a lot about foreshadowing and how most people can't go in real life where they first can't go in their minds. And so one of the things we like to do is talk about what's the possibility, what's the potential here. And what I just described to you actually was one of my first experiences entering EBMC. And I'm not saying it's perfect, right? And I don't know how somebody else would have experienced entering, but that was my experience entering EBMC. And what does it mean to have that and to be have the responsibility and the accountability and the intention and the love for whatever you're trying to build? What does home look like? What does Sangha look like for the people you're inviting in? So we kind of want us to start there. And a few key points just from the top, easy summary. Is one of the things we talk a lot about around to do this work, you have to be intentional. It has to be foundational. It has to be structural. It's not okay to slap frosting onto things, that you'll find that the cake will crumble very easily under the weight of something that isn't authentic. We also talk about cultural humility a lot at the center. We do a lot of listening at the center. Our whole thing always is ask first. Don't assume that we know, ask first, and then, like the story, be honest about our capacity to provide, and then if we can, then offer, and know that it's an offer and an invitation. We also talk a lot about gift economics as not something that's just about Dana and a practice that we do in the Dharma, but that is incredibly key for access, that you can't talk about radical inclusivity or radical welcome without also talking about gift economics. And to honor all our efforts in this, right, this is ongoing work. This is not a destination. This is how we practice and how we live. So I just wanted to... that was kind of our little welcome, and I wanted to turn it over to Xiaojing to tell you, what did it take EBMC? What did we have to set up foundationally and structurally in order to create that experience as somebody who myself, you know, I'm a woman, a queer woman of color, who has, I'm hearing impaired, I have chronic migraines, I have asthma, what it meant for me to enter someplace and feel completely at home. So I'll turn over to Xiaojing.
We acknowledge that EBMC is a work in progress. At the same time, we want to share with you some of our best practices that we've developed over the past 10 years. And one of the key takeaways is if you build it, they won't just naturally come, which I think Christine really showed us in that story about our first Spanish-speaking Sangha. And so... you know, what we really found was that to have policies and practices that speak to our value and our mission is really critical. And it might not be as fun as finding and setting up a beautiful physical space or developing a really innovative new mindfulness curriculum, but it is so important if that is part of the mission of what you're trying to accomplish. You know, it's really our policies and practices have really been our rock and the source of our resilience and the reason why we've been able to make it 10 years on an all gift economic system. And the first thing I want to talk about is the demographics of our leadership and of our teachers. What we really realized is that whatever is your highest priority demographic group, it's ideal that that manifests into the majority of the leadership of the organization. So that could be the board or the staff or the teachers. So for example, if you want to attract and retain community that includes people of color, because that's where you're situated and that's your intention, then you really need to show visibly that more than 50% of your leadership are people of color. And you know, this takes time. So you have to be patient. And, you know, I think the fruits of that labor will really pay off and it'll be the foundation, like Christine said, of the house that you want to build. So at EBMC, we have a leadership sangha and we have over almost 100 teachers in our teacher sangha. And we try very hard to make sure that those groups are demographically reflective of our communities and of the sangha that we strive to be. So this includes not only race, ethnicity, but gender identification, sexual orientation, physical ability, age, and so on. And, you know, policy-wise, at EBMC, we asked for teachers who are teaching day-long retreats and class series that the white teachers teach with a teacher of color. An exception are our core teachers, of which now we have six, who have really demonstrated their commitment as allies and who have demonstrated their experience teaching to inclusive and diverse communities. And something else that we work on is our diversity of our board. And to make sure that we can counteract the inherent class bias in volunteer board work, from the beginning, we offer a stipend for board members so that those who have financial constraints are still able to serve and still able to take on that leadership role. So creating warm and inviting spaces. So as a meditation center that's rooted in Buddhist traditions, our founders were very wise in recognizing that in order for folks to feel able and comfortable to step through that Dharma doorway, there needs to be a feeling of being welcome. There needs to be that doorway and an opening. And because of that, intentionally, our first practice group was a people of color sangha, followed by our LGBTQI, same gender loving, two-spirit community, which we lovingly call the Alphabet Sangha. and then our first meditation classes were beginning series for people of color. And that's how I actually came to EBMC, was attending one of those classes. So, you know, this was all done because our founders recognized that in the quote-unquote Western convert Buddhist spaces, it's, you know, the folks that we were trying to attract were underrepresented. So we wanted to create that safe and inviting space. Now we have a weekly group that's Everybody, Every Mind, which is for people living with disability and chronic illness. We have a long-term White and Awakening Sangha program where Sangha members who want to explore being allies and who want to explore whiteness through a Dharma lens, they have that space. There are a lot of them, and they're always growing. And these groups are created in direct response to asking the community, what groups, what spaces do you need to feel whole in our community of spirit, in our practice space? So we have social justice lunchtime sangha, we have a multiracial deep refuge group, we have Alphabet Brothers of Color. You know, some of them are open to all and some have already formed in our closed groups. So as a programming director, I love to get into the nitty-gritty of how we do programming. I think it's really important in how we fulfill our mission. So we really want and aim to have majority people of color at our center. That's part of what we value. And to do that, we have a policy where we set registration to 40% people of color for all of our classes. And this is extremely hard logistically. It takes a lot of work on the staff level, but because we really value it, we take the time and we dedicate the resources to making it happen. And we also dedicate a third of our programming every year to classes that are for our specific groups and communities. So for example, we have at least two classes a year for the Alphabet Sangha. We have at least two retreats a year for our Everybody, Every Mind Sangha. We have our longer term programming for our White and Awakening program, Sangha members. And then, you know, because our mission is really about social justice, we really try to work that into our curriculum as well. So we work on 6-month and year-long programs, and some of the ones that we've recently developed have been social justice and the Eightfold Path, exploring each one of them through a social justice lens. And right now we have a wildly popular Path of the Bodhisattva curriculum. because it really speaks to our community members' desire to serve. So, you know, operations is not very glamorous, but it really is how people experience a space. When you walk into a space, the operations component is what people really feel, interact with. And so we put a lot of thought into that. We have a fragrance-free policy that's very strict because we have community members with asthma, with multiple chemical sensitivity, and we want them to be safe and healthy in our space. So we train our volunteers and we train our event coordinators on how to compassionately ask folks who are heavily fragranced when they come to leave and come back another time. And that's a difficult conversation. And then physical material access, so here's a story going to Christine's work. A few years ago, about 4 years ago, we lost our storefront space where we had first opened. And as you can imagine, it was a time of, you know, crisis for us. And especially in downtown Oakland during a time of gentrification, it's hard to find spaces that we could afford. And for a while, it seemed like we would have to move to the second story space that had stairwell and one elevator. And we have an access committee of volunteers, and they put their feet down. They said, no way. They said they would pick it outside if we moved there. Because, you know, we need a space where our Sangha members who move in wheelchairs felt safe and protected. And so we listened to that, and we started searching all over again, and we found a space where we've been for the past 4 years that has really met our needs. And it really just reaffirmed our commitment to having an accessible space. You know, we also have a very strict policy that teachers and everyone speaking has to use a microphone, even though some people feel like they can project in a small room. And we try to make sure all of our written materials are at least 14-point font or larger, so it's easy to read. Our agreements for multicultural interaction is very important. And we have them in every room. They're huge. They take up entire walls behind our altar. And that's on purpose so that teachers and everyone at the center can refer to them, especially when there's a conflict or there's something that's uncomfortable happening. And trauma-informed language. So Christine's going to really go into more detail about this. So all I will say is that this is really an area of growing edge for us. And it's a place where our community now is really pushing us and supporting us in developing. Gift economics. So we have five principles of gift economics at the Meditation Center. And it's really too much to go into fully in detail. So I invite you to look at our website and our resources there. But, you know, it really is essential to everything we do because economic access is essential to creating an inclusive community, an inclusive Sangha. As I mentioned, you know, we operate on an all-Dana gift economics, no-fee system. And most of you probably know that Dana is a Pali word, meaning the generosity that develops naturally from a feeling of very deep gratitude. So we don't charge fees, except for 1 to 2 fundraising events per year. And, you know, we really rely on the joyful reciprocity of people in our community to keep us going. And this is not just money, but it's skills, it's time. You know, our center is cleaned by our temple keepers who are volunteers. I manage a lot of the technology, and that's all done by volunteers. And I don't even understand what they're saying half the time, but they step up and they create our website, manage our database. So it's really, we feel like it makes us a stronger community when everyone feels like they're contributing as well. And, you know, we also rely on Dana because as a Buddhist-based center, we recognize that the Buddha and other wisdom teachers taught us that generosity is an essential component of spiritual liberation and freedom. And that is a really important teaching for us.
So I wanted to go into the second section. And, you know, Xiaojing and I and others who were prepping for today wanted to really offer some things that felt concrete, you know, because it's sometimes hard to be on this road to shift your own culture and be like, where do I start on this, right? And we didn't want just to stay in the places where kind of we knew we were strongest. We wanted to be in learning with you. And so the next section around trauma-informed language and trauma-sensitive language is something that I want to be aware of that, and just say very frankly that I am not a psychotherapist. I am not a licensed practitioner to deal with trauma. I am a survivor myself around PTSD and rape and assault. And so I relate to this more from the sense of what has been helpful for me as a practitioner. And I also was able to take part of a year-long program at EBMC called Practice in Transformative Action. It was with Mushim Ikeda. I don't know if some of you have sat with Mushim. And it was basically how to integrate mindfulness and social justice work. And I was first exposed to some of this, what seems to be very simple steps that has completely shifted some of our training spaces, actually, in my social justice work. And so we wanted to share some of this with you all as a way then to uplift maybe what has been happening in your work and what you've been learning, and just share a little bit about what we've been learning here. So I just have two quotes here, one from an artist, Santiago Martinez Delgado. I am not myself. I am the result of all my ancestors. And then a fellow PETA-er, Practice in Transformative Action, and somebody who runs East Point Academy, Kazu Haga. He does Kingian nonviolence work. And he says, if we carry intergenerational trauma, then we also carry intergenerational wisdom. There's a whole body of work emerging around intergenerational and historical trauma. And I have been lucky this summer to get to learn from another group that's called Generative Somatics. And some of you know GS. I'm such a huge fan. I feel like a groupie these days. But you know, it's something that I really feel in my body around that our muscles and our tissues carry the memory, right? And what does it mean that as we're in this practice and as we're lifting up body awareness for those of us that hold all kinds of things in our bodies, and how can we be in this world without holding some level of suffering? And for a lot of the communities that we work with, deep, 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 deep trauma. And I'm often in training spaces, as you can imagine, with story and narrative, where that will uplift things. And at some point, people are no longer talking to each other. Their triggers are talking to each other. And George Lakey, who does a bunch of facilitation and training, talks a lot about when we are at our edges and our margins, we're not able to learn at our highest capacity. And so what are the ways in which we are able to be trauma sensitive and trauma informed? Because we are here to teach the practice, right? We're here to get free. We're here to end all suffering. And what does it mean when we can't hold a space that just constantly re-triggers people? So this has been something that, you know, we really feel pretty deeply about, especially in this moment. I mean, this is a high moment of accountability in the world, the earth, women. And we're coming up to the edges of our fractures and our fissures. And so as we see this come up in spaces, it's been like, what are concrete things we can do to hold space? But I wanted to go through a couple of things that we learned from our friends over at Niroga Institute who do mindful movement work. And these are first seem, again, really simple, but I found in my personal practice have been really influential. So here we talk about how do we use concrete language. So using this to maintain focus and avoid frustration, alienation, and images that can re-trigger people. So we have here a couple of examples of, instead of something like root your feet down towards the center of the earth, and don't get me wrong, I'm a poet. I love the flowery language. I would be like, you're a tree in the forest. And sometimes that's appropriate. And sometimes when I'm working with certain communities, that isn't where I start. Sometimes people just need to hear, feel into your feet, press down evenly with both of your feet. There's something even, right, I learned this from some of my favorite teachers. I always try to emulate this because I don't think I have it yet, is around how to be a mountain, to be something that is a steady presence as people are learning. And the concrete language is one that I found in some of my favorite teachers is just such a level of clarity, which I appreciate actually in some of Jack and Tara's guided meditations that I listen to quite a bit. So again, bring your hearts to your heart, your hands to your heart chakra, bring your palms together to the middle of your chest. Very simple, right? And you start to get a feel for when you can be in which type of language over others. But very simple things to change, to just give your teachings more access to more people. So the next one is around positive language. And this one's so hard because our instincts, our brains automatically go to the negative. And something they say in Jeddah Somatics is that the body learns on yes. So anytime that our language starts with a don't, a no, we actually have an automatic barrier. We're making it automatically harder for somebody to learn something new and to invite in a new practice. So very simple, right? Instead of don't scrunch your fingers together, it's spread your fingers wide. Well, a lot of my favorite yoga teachers talk about getting space between your toes. That's a nice one, right? Invitational language. So this one is around for those of us who have been through trauma and can have PTSD from triggers around directive language. This allows participants to proceed at their own pace. So instead of a directive, now reach back and hold your ankles. Some people can't actually do that. I'm all, wait, I know, I'm like, what are we talking about here? So we'll do a lot of, if it feels comfortable, if this is something you have access to, you can reach back and hold your ankles. This is like little turns of phrases that honestly just shape things really nicely. Encouraging language. This one's pretty simple. Again, very linked to the negative language, right? And how to use positive language. Use as frequently as possible instead of foreshadowing failure. This might be hard for some of you, but good luck. it's more of a noticing, right? Invitation. See how much you can do. Explore your edges. That's affirming language. So trying to focus on what's meaningful. Often it is easier to do things that are simple and on the surface. As we start to get deeper, especially around practice, learning how to actually give affirmations that are meaningful to people, it's really surprising what sticks with people over years and years and years. So I always like to hear this one, that haircut looks really good on you. However, it is very powerful, especially I feel really, I'm a beginner in my practice. And so when a teacher affirms for me, like, you look really strong and focused, or I could tell you were grounded and you were feeling into your lower body in that practice, I'm like, yeah. And I didn't want to tell them like it was for 2 seconds. I'm just like, you saw me on that good 2 seconds. Okay. Exploratory language, same thing. How do we encourage curiosity and the self-awareness? I mean, this is the heart of Vipassana. So instead of your right arm should feel light, you're like, oh crap, it doesn't feel light. Notice how your right arm feels. Leave some space open for whatever's happening, right? And truly letting whatever is arising arise for folks. And then finally, neutral language. This one's hard. We do not, like, sorry, let me speak from the eye. I don't realize how much I do this and that we are all actually operating off of whatever norm or habit. There is always some kind of dominant that's operating. Another Jeddah Somatics saying is, you're always in practice. The question is, which practice? And so instead of, you can keep your knees up or just keep them down on the mat. There's a piece of judgment in there, right? That is already snuck in there versus you can keep your knees down or raise them off the mat. It's your choice. And what's interesting for me, and I found in this in word selection and around language, is that what I learned about PTSD of my own is that snippets actually will trigger somebody. It's not actually full thoughts and full things. It's like some words will do it. And it's even sometimes the tone. So words like just judgmental slip-ins. Often I find this with folks who experience childhood trauma around this, especially around neutral language. So this one is a really good one to interact with. So we just wanted to offer a couple of our concrete practices that we've been using around trauma-informed and trauma-sensitive language.
And we want to also share that diversity includes a diversity of thought, and that having opposing and different viewpoints can often create a lot of conflict. And so learning to be okay with friction and making that conflict productive is really important and will help your community grow as well. And related to that, budgeting for a good facilitator. So, you know, growth is incremental. There are rough patches. Things get messy. And we found that it's really important to have a great neutral facilitator. And that will really help a group and a community get through those rough patches. And it's really money very well spent. And then finally, and this is, you know, so important, I think about this all the time, is not taking our cultural conditioning so personally. You know, building a capacity to tolerate that discomfort when we're opening up to different cultures and different people. And, you know, being willing to hang out in that space of the unknown, it's really helped me get through this work and make it productive and fun and joyful. And so it's something that we really want to offer all of you as well. And so we have a final quote from another one of our beautiful teachers, Thich Nhat Hanh, who says, "If we are a drop of water and we try to get to the ocean as only an individual drop, we will surely evaporate along the way. And to arrive at the ocean, you must go as a river, and the Sangha is your river."